Today's episode of the Film Stage Show is brought to you by MUBI, the online streaming cinema. For your free 30-day trial, go to mubi.com/filmstage.
Almost heaven, West Virginia, Blue Ridge Mountains, Shenandoah River. Life is old there, older than the trees, younger than the mountains, growing like a breeze. Country roads, take me home to the place.
Ladies and gentlemen, to a brand new episode of the Film Stage Show, the movie review podcast for thefilmstage.com. As always, I am your host, Brian J. Rowan, my team today to talk about Logan Lucky. We have Michael Snydell.
Hello.
And we have Bill Graham.
Woo!
Yes, we're here today, as I said, to talk about Logan Lucky, the newest film from newly unretired filmmaker Steven Soderbergh. This movie stars Channing Tatum and Adam Driver, amongst a murderer's row of other Hollywood talent, and we are going to talk about its quality. So, you can all look forward to that. Before we do, the usual Michigas, we have ourselves there on Twitter. You can find us at Film Stage Show. Facebook, search for The Film Stage Show. Email us, podcast@thefilmstage.com. And of course, give us a comment and rating on iTunes, because we're all about that. Love that shit. And other than that, the usual stuff to plug, we are still on Patreon, so if you would like to become a patron of ours and help us produce more special episodes like our review of Eraserhead, then all you have to do is go to patreon.com/thefilmstageshow or look for the link on the page that this episode is posted or in the description on your podcatcher of choice. Give us as little as $1 per episode to help us produce more awesome stuff for you to listen to. And, of course, we are brought to you by MUBI, the online streaming cinema. MUBI offers you some of the best films that you can see anywhere, right in your home, either on your cell phone, or, preferably, your computer, direct to your TV using their wonderful Roku app, or their app on any other of the streaming devices of your choice. All you have to do for a free 30-day trial of MUBI is go to mubi.com/filmstage, and you will get a free 30-day trial so that you can understand the wonder that is MUBI. Great thing about MUBI is that you can download their selections directly to your mobile device of choice. And they introduce one new movie a day that lasts for 30 days, so you constantly have a rotating selection of 30 films to choose from. So you're never going to get bogged down in the choice paradox that freezes us up and destroys our new movie watching. And you'll always have something new to look forward to every day. So that's mubi.com/filmstage for your free 30-day trial. So guys, Logan Lucky. Not Lucky Logan.
Not Lucky Logan.
Although we have a movie called Logan and a movie called Lucky this year.
Wait, was there a movie called Lucky this year?
There is. It's with it stars Harry Dean Stanton. It's directed by I think John Carroll Lynch is the director. I think it comes out next month.
So there's so we've had Logan. Now we have Logan Lucky, and then next month we're gonna have Lucky.
Yes.
So the release date goes Logan Lucky Lucky.
Yes.
Okay. Great. Anyway.
Awesome.
This movie, written by Rebecca Blunt, directed by Steven Soderbergh, who a couple years ago had quote-unquote retired from filmmaking. He's back. This movie brought him back.
Should we say Rebecca Blunt is not a person?
We can't confirm that, Bill. That is
there's some other I've seen conflicting reporting, one that this is another one of Soderbergh's many pseudonyms, or the possibility that this is actually his wife.
Yes.
And her first screenwriting credit.
So for anyone who doesn't know, Steven Soderbergh has a pseudonym for his cinematography and his editing.
I think he has multiple for cinematography.
those are the big ones that usually get name checked. And now there's a conspiracy theory that Rebecca Blunt may in fact be Steven Soderbergh.
Yes.
Or,
oh,
as Michael said, it may also be his wife. Who knows?
Sure.
Let's just, I mean, who fucking knows? We just don't
there know. There was an interesting report I saw that it said that Adam Driver, Channing Tatum, and Daniel Craig would all email back and forth to this anonymous source who is apparently emailing out of the UK.
Okay. Anyway, yeah. So...
Which I love the idea that Steven Soderbergh would go through that much subterfuge just...
What a crazy, like all of this is just so bananas for someone of his caliber and someone of his just like, it's just like, you would expect that from maybe like an indie filmmaker, like for his first movie to be like, sure, like Swan pull Kirk some shenanigans, right. But like, this is just bananas. Like, and it continues, like, and it's not.
And it's for this movie.
Yes.
Like, this is not like some powder keg igniting socially conscious fucking drama.
sure
it's Ocean's 7-Eleven, as the movie calls itself. Anyway, so Lucky Logan, fuck Logan Lucky. Well, nice. Maybe I got it out of my system now. Logan Lucky is the story of a man by Channing Tatum. His name is Jimmy Logan, and he has decided to engineer a heist after losing his job and finding out that he may need to hire a lawyer to fight for custody of his daughter. And it's all about him getting his team together and trying to pull off the heist successfully. Does he do it? We'll tell you in spoilers. But for now, here is the trailer for Logan.
Jimmy, I'm just gonna say it. I gotta let you go.
You were just fired.
I was let go for liability reasons involving insurance.
The one-armed bartender.
You need to show a little respect.
Charlotte Motor Speedway.
I know how they move the money.
The only guy who knows anything about blowing up real bank vaults is Joe Bang.
I am incarcerated.
Yeah, we got a plan to get you out.
All right, so that is a trailer for Logan Lucky. Don't laugh at me. Let's see what we all thought about it. For anyone who couldn't pick it up off of the thing, the plan is to... rob the Charlotte Motor Speedway, basically stealing the cash that is gathered from concessions. So, yeah, let's get into it. Bill Graham, start off with
sure.
You. What did you think of Logan Lucky?
I'll be very blunt and upfront. I absolutely adored this film from beginning to end. This is one of the rare few movies during the summer. I mean, I guess technically it's not quite the summer because school is back in session, but it is still August, whatever. Anyways, it is one of the few like summer movies that I basically looked at my two friends that I went to go see this movie with afterwards, and I was just like, that was really good. And they both were like, yes, yes, very much so. It is a delight. Like, it reminds me so much of the comedy in this is a little bit drier than maybe a lot of people might be expecting. But overall, it's just a delight to see all of these people performing. And, you know, it is kind of a jigsaw puzzle film. Soderbergh, you know, did a great job with Ocean's 11, and some people even think like Ocean's 12 is actually better, right? I'm not mistaken on that front, maybe.
I think that's a weird thing that some people have started to say, but like,
yeah,
I feel like it's kind of an auteur argument, like a lot of those people.
But like, okay, when it was released, people were like, "Oof,
yeah, goof, sure,
this fucking sucks."
Yeah. Anyways, it is a delight. I love the way that the pieces kind of come together. Daniel Craig is doing like, oh my God, he's so good in this. And it's one of those things where he's obviously playing a little bit against type. Well, not a little bit, way against type, right? But it's just so delightful from beginning to end. I love how smart it is. And it's not the smart where it's kind of thumbing its nose at you, like maybe a film that has, you know, like five different reversals at the end where you're just like, okay, come on, seriously. This movie has just a couple of reversals. That's about it. It's really smartly laid out. They walk you through a lot of things. And it's just a delight from beginning to end, whether it's the setting, which – you know, I guess maybe Soderbergh has some experience in, but like maybe not. I don't know. He just nails like the Southern kind of antics. And
he grew up in Boca Raton. I do know that.
Oh, interesting. Okay. So that's Louisiana, right?
No, that's Baton
Rouge. Florida?
I thought Boca Raton was in Florida.
Yes. Oh, Florida. Okay. Okay. Baton Rouge, Florida, whatever. Anyways. Yeah. It's just so delightful from beginning to end. I love the action. I love the set pieces. I love everything that's kind of drawn out. Seth MacFarlane is doing his damnedest to be as annoying as possible, and he's good at that. And that's exactly the character that's written and drawn for him, and so it's kind of perfect. So even Seth MacFarlane being in this movie can't knock it off. Like, it's a strut from beginning to end. I think it's a little over 2 hours, isn't it? And it just flows incredibly well. From beginning to end, I enjoyed myself. And there are a hell of a lot of people in this film that are just awesome, awesome, awesome. So, yeah, I loved it. I really don't have a lot to complain about, to be honest with you. It's one of those rare films where I was just like, wow, that was delightful.
All right. Well, let's see what Michael Snydell thought. Michael Snydell.
Yeah, I'm more mixed on this one, unfortunately. Let me say this first, and Bill started to get into this. But this nails all of the small stuff that a lot of people just kind of overlook because they think it's not important, but it's kind of incredible to see how much Soderbergh, how interested he is in just fleshing out, you know, these characters through little gestures and just the introductions, like, and the way that he is playing at every turn with, you know, the kind of red state, blue state, like the kind of like divisive assumptions that we have about those. Like, literally, interestingly enough, like the first scene of this movie is Channing Tatum's character, like working on his car, and his daughter's right there who he's talking to, and he's given this great soliloquy about a John Denver song, of all things, and she's just like, she's just familiar with the tools that are right next to her. Like, he asked for a very specific kind of spanner or wrench. Man, I know so much about cars. my point being,
Boca Raton is in fucking Louisiana. He was looking for a spanner instead of a wrench.
All right. My point being, it is like a specific size of wrench. All right, you know what? I'm not going to try to salvage this point anymore. But what I can say about this is that Soderbergh absolutely gets across that way of, you know, that the South can feel, you know, so eccentric to someone else without pandering and without condescending. So it is definitely weird for a bit for seeing these big stars, you know, give these very folksy accents for a bit, but it, like, he nails all of that in between stuff. It is the larger beats that I think he kind of loses his footing. I think that, interestingly enough, I kept wanting this movie to get back to the domestic qualities, like just watching Channing Tatum, you know, be a dad in, you know, his character in, you know, Magic Mike, this like, down to earth, very immediately likable character. But I think that Soderbergh being Soderbergh, he's not willing to just do a heist film. I mean, I understand why this is obviously compared to Ocean's 11 and Ocean's, you know, the Ocean's trilogy. But true to kind of his latter day stuff, this absolutely feels like an experiment in the same way that Haywire does, in the same way that like Side Effects is, you know, a psychological thriller that's actually a takedown of like the pharmaceutical industry. And this as well feels like it's wanting to make, you know, grand statements about, you know, the little guy taking down the big guy. And that is not only embedded like in, you know, like converse or in the dialogue, but literally like of the thematic threads of the whole film. But just there is just I can't say that Soderbergh is not intelligent about crafting this stuff, and just the way that he handles this very unusual heist it's clever and it's ingenious, but this movie as a whole just didn't work for me when you consider all the things that he's throwing in here. Like Bill briefly was talking about Seth MacFarlane's character, and so you have this subplot, you know, with these two NASCAR drivers that like kind of represents a reiteration of the perspectives of, you know, these characters who are usually yokels who we underestimate, and it provides like a contrast there, but just this stuff doesn't really work for me. And once you get into kind of the second and third act, this kind of reveals what it wants to be. And it's a very soulful movie. It's a movie that's interested in a lot bigger ideas than you would expect, given how laid back and laconic it is for the whole time. But by that point, I wanted to not feel like I was being guided through these two different movies. And I just wanted to spend time with these characters as they were written, rather than going through the motions of a heist movie that Soderbergh can do in his sleep.
So I'm gonna finish out the spectrum and just be wholly negative.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, this movie sucked. I mean, that's my nuanced, thoughtful decision, I guess. I'm sitting there watching it, and I'm not really reacting to anything. I actually found it pretty like offensive, and like in bad taste for the most part, and I didn't understand most of the choices that were being made. Like, if someone wanted to make a good movie, why would they do this? And it never, like, there's no momentum to any of the scenes. Like, nothing ever builds up to anything. When it feels like it's finally over, it goes on for another 20 minutes and introduces another character who's god awful. And
I didn't know if we should mention that yet, but
yeah,
I agree with that. I agree with that point.
Or what their purpose is, but like, goddamn, oh my god. Yeah, it's just like it feels like Soderbergh is playing a really mean spirited joke on anyone who doesn't live on a coast. Like, it's as though he's like, all right, let me take the template for Ocean's 11, which was all like studied cool and real affluence and highbrow humor and all this other stuff, and he says, now let's strip all that away and then let's make it appeal to these slack-jawed yokels you know, blue state or red state motherfuckers who probably voted for Trump and who suck, and let's see if I can squeeze some money out of them. Because if the Ocean's movies made a shit ton of money, then, you know, this movie ought to make like fucking billions, because, you know, we mentioned NASCAR and fucking Seth MacFarlane's in it. I mean, I don't know. I wasn't angry about it when I first got out of the theater. I was just kind of like, all right, well, that happened and it was fine. And I don't know what I'm going to say about it, because it's just, it exists and then it's over. And I don't understand.
Well, at what point do you make the bad faith jumps?
I guess, but, like, just thinking about it. And you know, given some of the turns it makes that seem baldly unnecessary, and, like, I, unfortunately, some of it's in spoilers, but, like, there's a sing-along at some point that I felt like it feels like the type of thing that you'd get in, like, a shitty movie from the 90s that was just trying to, like, have that moment. And it doesn't ever feel, like, earnest. It doesn't ever feel like it's trying hard enough to feel like anything other than just, like, a bad faith kind of cash grabby, you know, let's try to play one for the dudes in the sticks type of thing. And, like having Katie Holmes be, like, Channing Tatum's ex-wife who is, like, dating, or I guess married now, to a guy who runs a car dealership and, like, has a Ford hat on all the time and talks about, like, taking his sons to the Fast and Furious movies, and, like, he doesn't care if they're, like, not appropriate. He just wants his kids to shut up. Like, it left, like, stuff like that in the theater. I was like, all right, that's just a choice that's not working for me. But then after a while, like, you know, going on the rest of my day, like, I went to the grocery store and then I came home and then I mowed my lawn, and, like, the entire time, every time I thought about this movie, it came back to me with, like, just a little bit more dark, like a dark
vitriol
to it. And, like, every time I thought about it again, I just kind of kept getting, like, sort of pissed at it. And now I just, like, I can't think of a single thing that really unequivocally worked for me. And so I just kind of don't like it at all. And if you told me that this movie was directed by anyone other than Steven Soderbergh, I would have been like, well, yeah, obviously this is probably directed by the guy who did, like, Evan Almighty or some nonsense like that, you know, like the guy who directed, like, The Last Mimsy, which is a movie that I only just now remembered was a thing. Like, it feels so out of step with the interesting Soderbergh we're used to. And he's a guy who's like Richard Linklater. If he makes a seemingly mainstream movie, you can at least usually expect something else in it. And so I don't know if that's, like, but he... Even if it was, like, a no-name director who made this, the fact that there's so many stars in it, like, it really just does feel like a super cynical, like, bad faith, like, condescending, just piece of garbage that they spat out to try to make money off of people that they thought were too stupid to pay them for this fucking movie the first time when it was named Ocean's 11. Like, I just don't know. It just is and it's not fun, it's not funny. I don't feel like I was ever really entertained. I didn't like this movie.
Okay.
Yeah.
This will be an interesting discussion.
I feel like I keep trying to ask Brian some more stuff, but since you are way more positive, I'm really interested to hear some of your opinions about, like, Brian's, like, bad faith.
Well, I mean, I discussion. Can't get into it because I don't. All he keeps saying is it's bad faith. So I'm not sure.
I gave you the example of. I feel of like I didn't just say it was bad faith. I felt like I gave a bunch of examples.
You gave the David Denham's character. You know, like,
okay, so he's a yeah. shitty stepfather. I don't understand, like, beyond that, he's kind of a snake oil salesman. He's, you know, trying to sell. I know, but he's an asshole about it. He's trying to sell this woman that probably cannot afford this car a brand new Mustang when he should be trying to sell her, like, a decent, nice something, right? Not a top, top of the line V6 Mustang that then he pulls up with a V8, you know, standard Mustang, and it's just decked out from top to bottom. And it's just like, what are you doing? Like, she drives an old Nova. That doesn't make any sense. You're an asshole. You're clearly flaunting the money that you don't really have in front of her and just being a dick about it. Like, he's a dick. He's a dick from top to bottom.
But he's a dick in such a specifically, like, I don't know. It just,
there, I think there's, I think it is interesting that you seized on him particularly, because I think he's broad in a way that the rest of the movie is not. And well, I know you probably
beyond McFarlane, but yeah, like, sure. He's supposed to stick out. He's supposed to not be a redeemable character. He is supposed to be just a big asshole. Like,
Then I'll give another one. The two brothers who are like layabouts and who claim to know all the Twitters, like,
sure,
things like, there's just every joke in this at the expense of these people feels like super easy and like not,
but they're also extremely proficient, all of these people at the same time, so that's why like I feel like I will agree with you that the line is thinner than I would like, but I think that Soderbergh is very much trying to take all of those bad faith assumptions and then fight back at them by making all of these characters the heroes of the story. Like, he is, like, you know, cherry picking from assumptions. You know, the very fact that Channing Tatum's character at the beginning gets fired from a construction job for a pre-existing condition, or Adam Driver's character being a veteran who's, you know, lost a limb. You are dealing with very much like these themes and these archetypes that are very much like Red State. But I feel like then he's undergirding them with all of this very authentic understanding of what it's like even living in the South. And I say that obviously as someone living in the Midwest, but there's nothing that feels strained to me about this. Like, even the momentum, like not only it being like forget about it being anti Ocean's 11, which I think kind of does it a disservice weirdly, but just like there's something about the basic rhythms of this movie where like there are times where you think it's going to be a joke and it will be just like watching them be at the bar for a bit, like having a drink and just talking about, you know, like the family curse, like they're, and Brian, like, let's be clear that I am mixed about this movie, but I do think that the questions about like authenticity, I feel like the movie creates enough like complexity with each of those, you know, potential problems that like that's alleviated. Like it's not as smooth as I would like, but I don't know. Like, other than the Denham character and the McFarlane character, I think that a lot of those characters.
But I mean, you're basically saying that like it's fine to treat them this way as long as you make them smart in like one other way.
I mean, that's not.
How do you deal with the fact that this film is set in the South, that this film is set where it is, it's going to have these caricatures, and the whole like caricature idea is basically like Michael's saying, it's basically taking this idea that, you know, they play it very kind of close. How they're actually going to break into this thing, how they're actually going to pull off this heist, how they're actually going to get Daniel Craig out of jail, you know, and all of these things. And it all turns into a very smart and interesting and complex but easy to kind of visualize and see and understand plan. And that's kind of the genius in my regard of this film is that it takes all of these characters who you would expect to do this, like, just be bumbling idiots, right? Because that's kind of how you're thinking that they're portrayed in certain ways, but they're not. They're actually fairly competent people, and maybe their vocabulary and dialogue isn't as complex as some people with a better education, but it doesn't matter because they know what they know, and they're good at, like, putting pieces together of, okay, this is your position, this is your kind of expertise, I'm going to rely on you to do that. And I think that's kind of the smart play here, and that's what it is. It would be no different from me looking at someone is a gangster who is given kind of a heart of gold or something like that. Like, it's just character detail that ends up fleshing these people out a little bit more. Is some of the Southern stuff played for laughs? Sure. But I think it's all in good fun. I don't think it's in bad faith at all. I think a lot of these people that are probably watching this movie can laugh at it because they can kind of laugh at themselves. And that's the biggest thing for me, is what kind of humor you have. Some people literally cannot laugh at themselves. Some people can't look at something like this and say and see themselves and see anything but just, like, red in their eyes, right? Whereas some people can see this and say, wow, that's, you know, kind of a delightful little take on small town America, or, you know, like, all of these different things. And this film, yes, it caters towards kind of maybe the redneck population, but it's like, but who is making films like this that would cater to those people? Because I don't necessarily know that, you know, I don't know. It's frustrating because, like, there's so many different things that I want to kind of point out, but like, he so clearly loves this kind of idea, whether it's Leanne Rimes singing the national anthem,
all of these set pieces
are so good. And he's got two of the state troopers are actually NASCAR, like fairly well-known NASCAR people. So there's, like, so many little things here that I think are, like, such integral parts of the celebration of NASCAR and the celebration of, like, all of these different systems and things like that, that I really enjoy. Because, yeah, if you drive an old school Chevy Nova and someone pulls up to you in a brand new Ford Mustang V6 and tries to taunt you with it, you're going to be like, A, that's a V6. Get away from me. B, you're driving an automatic, you silly goose. Like, nobody cares about your car. And so, you know, like, there's so many little delightful things like that hidden in this film that I really enjoy, that I think just aren't, I don't know. I'm surprised by your reaction to this, Brian. I really am.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to shock you like that. I mean,
That's fine.
I don't
it's
know what
fine.
To tell you. Like, it started out with me just thinking, like, wow, this movie's lazy. Like, this movie feels a lot like a Disney Channel original movie. Like, oh, my dad's not around and he's having a hard time, and so he's gonna
what Disney Channel movie? If you're going to name drop a Disney Channel movie, give me an example here.
Well,
come on.
What's weird is I keep thinking that this movie has, like, I didn't say this. It's not a Disney Channel movie. But what's that movie where Kevin Costner? Swing Vote. That's what I was going to go for, but I, for some reason, didn't want to say Swing Vote.
Okay.
And, but, like,
because, like, four people have heard of it.
Yeah, because, like, what is that going to mean to people? Or, like, what was the Hillary Duff movie where she went to camp and, like, sang?
Camp Rock?
No. It was, like, the last song or something like that. It's just one of those
things. What are you doing watching those movies?
I'm a cinematic.
I marathoned the High School Musicals earlier this year, and they're pretty damn good, I have to say.
I just feel like there has to have been a Disney Channel, or maybe Brink? No. My wife's going to be pissed if she listens to this, because I spent like 30 minutes telling her about Brink the other night, just to be an asshole. That's a story, but one I don't have to tell right now. Anyway, yeah, it's like there's the heist, of course, right? And that's not quite so Disney Channel movie. But then there's the like dad who's never there and like keeps missing his daughter's stuff. And then like, will he show up at the right time? And then what will she do that will make everyone cry and let everyone know how much they love each other? And
I think that stuff works though for me in the sense though, because you think it is about the heist and it is a little bit of a bait and switch. And even if that's a familiar like overall idea, I think it is weird that that stuff, like once the movie actually reveals what it's about, like it becomes like this sideways way into sentimentality. Like I don't think that stuff works quite as well as a lot of other people do, but I believe that's what a lot of people seem to be saying
I just feel like the heist doesn't work, the sentimentality doesn't work, the reversals don't work, the characters outside of Daniel Craig, but I think that's mainly hair working for him. I mean, it's just like the two idiot brothers are like a shitty version of Khan and Affleck from the Ocean's movies. And like, I just think back to other productions that have plumbed the oddity of you know, off the beaten path America, something like Justified, and like, that's something that I didn't feel was like in bad faith, even as it had like a lot of stereotypes and stuff. It always felt
sure
like it was tweaking it just enough and giving these people enough interiority and meaning and purpose to like make it different. So like, when Mag,
there's a Boyd Crowder. Well, you know, there's some Boyd Crowder-ish stuff in here for sure.
But like, okay. So if this has a Boyd Crowder though, it doesn't have like Mags Bennett and her sons. Like, it doesn't have Dickie and the other one, the bigger one. It's like it doesn't have these people. Like, no one in this really feels entirely connected. And then towards the end, when people start getting envelopes, you start to say like, oh, that person was important in any way. Like, that's a strange twist for me, because the movie didn't seem to give a shit about that person. I don't know. Like the movie has an ending that feels like it's making fun of other movies that end that way. But it seems to be doing it in earnest. And again, like, I just don't think that they did. And like those two layabout idiot brothers, like they have like this weird thing about how they turn to Jesus and stuff, but like that never comes to anything. Like, and don't talk to me about the moment near the vacuum, because that's barely there. Like,
okay,
it barely means anything.
So you're basically going to say, I'm going to give you an argument, and then your counter argument is invalid.
Yeah,
so don't even bring it up.
I am pre-invalidating your argument, because immediately that is a moment in time that is barely informed by anything else that they have done. And it is coming so late in the game that it makes their eventual counter argument to all of this seem especially weak, because they've already done it. It's not like that's a problem that comes in the planning stage when they realize what's going on. They wait until they're pretty much done to bring that up. And then it results, again, in nothing beyond that moment and wasting like 2 minutes of screen time with like an attempt at tension.
So, you know, I've had arguments with people. I've had fights with people. And a lot of times it is not beforehand of something that is happening, it is right in the middle of the shit. And you're like, why didn't you bring this up earlier? And people were like, well, because it wasn't that important. Everything was going well, and now it's going to shit, and now I'm going to complain about it. And so that's, to me, that's kind of like life. Like, that's people don't often, especially when they're not an integral piece of planning and things like that, people don't often speak up, because they're like, well, I'm still going to go along with this, like, until I basically hit the breaking point, and usually the breaking point is right in the middle of something, and you're just like, why didn't you say anything earlier? Like, this is why, like that's argument 101 with, like, a spouse and shit like that is, okay, we're on our way to a restaurant, and the spouse is like, no, I don't want to fucking eat here. Or, you know, you're trying to get a table, and the wait is 45 minutes, and she's like, I knew I shouldn't have come here. Like, I hate this fucking place. I hate how long it takes, blah, 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 blah. And it's just like, well, why didn't you say this earlier? Like, that's like argument 101. Like, to me, is people often kind of keep it in until they just can't keep it in anymore, and then it blows up, and you're like, we're in the middle of the situation, why didn't you get out earlier, right?
Okay, but so, I'm gonna say something. That's life. This is a movie, and I feel like if you're gonna introduce something like that, it should be a meaningful complication. And in this movie, it is not a meaningful complication. It does not result in anything. Like, if you were to remove that from the movie, Bill, what would be changed about the movie?
But that's very Soderbergh. Like these things that feel at once totally superfluous, but also essential to, like, the growth of those two brothers. Like, that moment where they have to reckon with something.
But I don't feel like that wasn't a moment of growth. When we literally, when we see them later in the movie, they're in the same place they were when we saw them an hour earlier.
I don't really want to question that right now.
Yeah.
I want to know what you mean there, but I don't want to question that right now.
Well, we can move into spoilers. I mean, we move beyond general thoughts, and we are now arguing specific points and ideas that we all have. So I feel like we've given people a taste. And they've made up their mind whether they're going to see it. So apparently, it only made like $8 million this weekend. So
yeah,
I want to say this before we get into spoilers. I tweeted about this earlier. I think the trailers for this movie are absolutely atrocious. Like, it kind of reminds me of the same way that they tried to make Inherent Vice a comedy, in the trailers. And I think people, once they saw what they were getting into, were very confused. Like, I know a couple people who I could tell them this premise and they'd be into it, but then they saw the trailer and be like, what the fuck is this shit? So I do have to say, I know Soderbergh was actually pretty involved with the marketing. This might have actually been the first time that he wanted to be like,
do we know what pseudonym he did it under?
You know, it is interesting that you're mentioning that, because the friends that I went to go see this, they all said the trailer looked crazy and this film looked like a lot of fun. And a lot of that is based on who is actually in it and who it's coming from, more than it is actually like the trailer that necessarily sold them. But the movie does look very kooky and strange, and it looks like – it reminds me a lot of if Burn After Reading was – you know, kind of an advertising campaign. And I don't remember the trailers for Burnout. Well, I kind of do. I remember it sold it as kooky fun, and that's kind of what that film really delivered on, was just like bananas kooky fun. And this film delivers on that significantly less. The jokes in here are a little bit more subtle, a little bit more at times, right? So it is one of those films where the marketing either sold you on it or didn't. I was sold on it the first time I saw the trailer. I was just like, this movie looks insane. I can't wait to see it. But like, for me, obviously that was because I recognized all these actors and I recognized the director, and I was like, yeah, I'm definitely going to see this. So I don't know. I like the trailers. I'm surprised it didn't make that much money, because you would have figured that this many people behind the film would have helped kind of boost it. But I mean, I don't know how many screens it opened on. I'm pulling up
3,000.
Holy shit. And it made $8 million.
Yep.
And it is PG-13. So that's
and it
not,
has a that's shit like, ton of names in it. I mean, it's got Channing Tatum.
And it's 93%. It's 93% on Rotten Tomatoes. So, you know, shocking. If critics meant anything, people should have showed up in droves for this film, obviously. And they saw the 93% and nobody showed up for this movie.
Or it's almost like Rotten Tomatoes doesn't matter.
It's funny. It's funny that you say that. Right?
I feel like when we brought up that this movie would be something we talk about, I was like, when is that coming out? And someone said like, oh, it's this week. I feel like I didn't know about this movie. And I'm a guy whose job it is to know about movies.
Brian, you do know kind of the backstory about this film, right?
Steven Soderbergh came out of retirement, became a woman, wrote the screenplay. I don't know. Yes. No, I don't know the backstory.
So he made this outside of the studio system completely. The idea here was to basically make a studio film without the studio involved, I guess get independent financing and everything like that, and basically just shunt the studios completely. And what I had kind of heard coming into this weekend was that a lot of studios were kind of like sitting on pins and needles, basically saying, if this is a success, we're kind of fucked because he just released this on 3,000 screens and none of us were involved. I think Bleecker Street is the one handling the release, along with like Naked Films or something like that, which is probably just Fingerprint Releasing. So it's like, who? Huh? Whatever. It is what it is. It cost $29 million and it's grossed $8 million already. So, yeah.
It's just weird that this would be the movie that he decides to do that for. Like, I can't imagine it would be hard for this movie to get made in the studio system. Are we really that far gone?
I don't know. Like $30 million.
Mike, did you say definitely? Million.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know. With the names attached, maybe not. But a $30 million movies just aren't really made all that often anymore. They're kind of gone. So these kind of mid budget movies are not what's really made anymore. And I think, to be honest with you, I think that $30 million price tag would not have been attached to a film with this many stars if more than likely they didn't have like shares of the profit and things like that. So they're probably paid on scale and things like that as well. So, you know, I don't think you have this cast and this movie at $30 million if it was inside a studio system. I think it would have cost much more.
That's possible. That is possible.
I really have to say too, I mean – I guess maybe I'm just off and I can't stop looking at this through the lens of like late Soderbergh, but like this movie's a really strange blockbuster. Like I don't know, like just the pacing of this movie, I feel like would put a lot of people off, even who are expecting Ocean's 11 or even hearing it's anti Ocean's 11. Like it's just, it's constructed in such a way that like, it actively just ignores the story at quite a few times. So I'm not really that surprised that it didn't catch on. Like even besides marketing, like maybe you're right, Bill. And I mean, I hope this movie does well, honestly, even if I don't love it. But like, I do feel like this movie is much stranger than even it's being reviewed as.
It's subversive. It's in several different ways I found to be so. Yep, there. Okay, sure. I took away your argument.
No, it's. I mean, I. You didn't take away my argument. I'm just ready for a whole new argument. But let's have that argument lead us into spoilers. So spoilers.
Oh, I thought we were already spoiling. Yeah, that's right.
No, Mike said one thing before we get into spoilers.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
7 minutes ago. So, spoilers for Logan Lucky. I'm doing a good job of catching myself very naturally. I'm curious, Bill. Like, can you just give us some? What's some subversive shit that happens in this movie?
Like the whole plot line.
Okay. Moving on. Entire, Michael.
Yeah.
No. What do you mean the whole plot line?
It casts all of these hillbilly people to basically pull off this complicated and integral or like very nuanced heist that they end up kind of tweaking at the very end. And like so many of these little pieces make so much sense. Like I love the fact that they even covered the tracks through the prison system. I love the fact that they're hopping onto the fire truck at the end to basically install themselves back inside the prison. I love that they have a warden that they're basically utilizing who is just basically like, no, nothing's going on here. You guys are dumb. Go away. And it's like, really? Like, you could have helped. And yet, what does he do? He beats the shit out of Daniel Craig at one point because he basically knows, yeah, you did something. Like, you organized this, didn't you? Like, there's no reason why all of this shit is pointing to you and that you didn't actually have anything to do with this, you know? So
there's also something really subversive that this is like inherently about human decency. Like, you were mentioning that, you know, even the smallest people, like the person who they originally send the cake, like who's not even a character, but someone who was like affected negatively by the way that just the clockwork, like parts of the heist worked, that they still like paid this woman and like helped her. Like, there's just some people keep using the word sweetness that I don't really want to use that word, but there is, there's just like a sense of humanity here that doesn't necessarily come with most heists. And like it's almost like an answer to like the glibness and slickness of a lot of heist movies.
Sure. And, you know, there's something to be mentioned about the fact that, like, I don't think anybody ever actually has a gun in this film. You know, so it's one of these kind of very smooth, very nice and easygoing heists that kind of is pulled off because its complexity is so wound up in so many different aspects that, of course, it's one of those films that, you know, couldn't possibly actually happen unless it was just some kind of crazy circumstantial thing that all just kind of fell into place. But it is one of those.
It is one crazy circumstantial thing that all fell into place.
Like, sure.
Like, learning about how he knows about any of this is a little nuts.
Sure. And that's kind of, you know, a film like this wouldn't be nearly as fun if it didn't have a lot of that kind of circumstantial stuff, because that's kind of what like a lot of these heist films, unless it's something like, I don't know, Thief or something like that, where it's just like, no, I'm just really good at cracking safes and here we go. But, you know, there's always that kind of secret intel that someone has that kind of unlocks the key to all of these different things. But I don't know, like, I really enjoyed all the little aspects that add up to so much. And we were, you know, we were laughing beforehand during kind of the talk leading into this podcast. And one of the things that I had mentioned was how hilarious that Game of Thrones bit was. And Brian, you said that, like, unequivocally nothing in this film worked. How did you think about the prison sequence? How did you think about that Game of Thrones reference in particular and things like that, since we can finally get into it, since we're in spoilers?
It's the thing that kind of came closest to working.
You weren't laughing?
No.
Wow. Yeah, I didn't like the Game of Thrones joke either. Sorry, Bill.
It's something that's so... I kind of hate stuff like that in movies. It dates itself fucking hard.
Sure. Like,
super hard. And like, you have to be aware of all of those things. Like, that is something that is so for people like me who are on Twitter and watch Game of Thrones and know all that stuff.
Mm.
And it's just, it was like groaning under the weight of its own like nonsense, and I couldn't deal with it. It was like, I can see how this could be funny, but also like Dwight Yoakam's performance of that was so laconic that it was like someone gave him tranquilizers beforehand. Like, I think at that point what you need is like someone who's gonna give it some manic energy and some juice. And
yeah, but that's not his character at all,
right,
though.
So he's unfunny.
Yeah, but like his reaction to that.
I understand that that's his character, but it's not funny because that's his character. Like, you saying that that's on purpose doesn't make it more funny for me.
Sure. And I understand that. Yeah. But I'm saying that made it funny to me. Like,
right. Yeah, the prison.
His kind of just like shrug of like, I don't know, man. Like I'm literally like, he even references Wikipedia and I'm just like, yes, thank you. Like this guy is in a pinch. He knows nothing about Game of Thrones. And this guy's like, you should give me this other book that should be released by now. And he's like, I don't know what the fuck you're talking about, but Wikipedia tells me this. So I don't know. You argue with Wikipedia, you know?
I think the thing about the prison sequence for me is less specifically, I mean, that joke is contributes to like my feelings, but like that whole sequence in the prison feels clever to me more than actually like interesting or like cohesive. Like I found little things really interesting, like the way that they start the riot and how there's like, it seems like there's going to be very explicit, like race-based way to like incite the riots, and the fact that like the TV has the race on in the background, like the way that it just layers distraction upon distraction upon distraction, but like that stuff also, like I don't necessarily need to spend time there. And I kind of felt that about a number of different threads, like especially Seth MacFarlane and Sebastian Stan, which like becomes not really anything of consequence other than the fact that like Sebastian Stan is like kind of a humble ivory tower, like protein bar addict. Like
I love that. Because I don't know how closely you follow sports, but there is that kind of narrative that is starting to pop up, whether it's talking about how, like, I think, you know, there's like this idea that Tom Brady hasn't eaten gluten in like 5 years or something like that. And like he dedicates his success as a football player to, you know, not eating gluten. And it's like, dude, your success is because you have a great fucking team around you and nobody is whacking into your knee anymore, because there specifically is a rule against that shit. Like, like it's like, okay. Sure, I guess you're healthy. Like, congratulations. You're what is he? He's like closing in on his 40s and he's still playing top-notch football. But it's like, yeah, I don't think gluten really has that much to do with it. Like, seriously. So, you know, like there is that kind of aspect.
But sometimes
I enjoy that stuff.
But sometimes that stuff just reminds me that because the big stuff doesn't work enough for me, that I kept wanting to get back to the small stuff. The conversations between Channing Tatum and his daughter, who I think is pretty excellent. I don't have her name in front of me, but or Adam Driver's character, like, or, you know, just their
Farrah McKenzie.
Yes. Thank you. Yeah, she's excellent. Or even their relationship with Melly. Like, mm-hmm. It is some of those things where it's just like, I understand that this wants to be like a wide scope, but at a certain point, I also think that it's shooting itself in the foot a little bit in trying to include all of this stuff in 2 hours. And I'm gonna throw this to you, Brian. And Hilary Swank.
And Hilary Swank shows up doing the world's worst Tilda Swinton impression. Uh-huh. And just like
what was that accent? Please tell me.
It wasn't an
Please.
Accent. It was like a it was like she had a, I don't know what she was doing. Her affect, everything was just off and wrong. And I was like, thank God that this appears to be over. And then she's there at the bar, and the movie ends with, like, the end, question mark? And I'm just like...
I like how she's with Macon Blair, by the way.
Yeah, I did enjoy Macon Blair being there. But it's like, why do that? Like, what is the purpose of introducing her? She hasn't been there the whole time, so you feel nothing when she shows up other than... nothing. Like, I really couldn't feel anything. I was curious.
I loved it. I loved when she, like, as soon as she appeared on screen, I was like, what the fuck? I can't believe she's in this movie. And then Macon Blair is next to her. I'm like, what? What is going on here? Like, this is insane.
Yeah, but, it was like, insane, but in a bad
okay,
way.
Okay. Let me say this, okay, Brian? You're saying her character was introduced at the last minute. The heist hadn't been done until the last minute. So, like, what?
But so, okay, so like...
She's an investigator.
Most heist movies, like, where something like this happens, you have been... with that person for a little bit, you know, like there's something that brings them in early, you know,
who and like this special, like, agent.
What
are you talking about? The special agent,
any kind of adversarial character, like in a normal movie, she would be like one of the track policemen or like track security, or she'd be like his fucking probation.
But that's kind
officer.
Of an example of subversion at the same time, isn't
exactly.
it?
Exactly.
But like, but that's subversion in the worst way, because you're taking something that usually works and doing it differently so it doesn't.
Still subversion.
I'm going to subvert the fucking sure. hamburger by putting a piece of wood instead of a fucking burger patty. Like that's
yeah,
that's
a terror. That's you're usually good with
no, she
analogies.
Is a
that
piece
was terrible.
Of wood at the end of this movie, she is okay. a plank that sits there with a weird voice, and then.
Well, none of this film worked
in the
for
final
you.
Part of the movie.
Like, none of this film worked for you. So, okay. That's the thing. It's like none of this film worked for you from beginning to end, and so that's just kind of like your thing. But like, I don't
that's
know.
Always
like
an opportunity
Bill,
for a movie to do something. Like you can't say from beginning to end it didn't work for me, and that explains why it didn't work for me.
Okay, can we let me put this more diplomatically, that will bring in our question as well, Brian. Okay, Bill, why not just go right to the reversal? What is the purpose of bringing in Hilary Swank's and Macon Blair's character for you?
What is the purpose, like the timing of it? I don't want them from the outset of the film.
Oh, no, of course not. But why?
Okay, go ahead.
No, sorry, please go ahead.
I don't know what else I'm answering right now. So
no,
you're saying like, why does the reversal work for me? Why does them appearing on screen work for me?
No, not necessarily that. I guess I'm merely referring to that. Like, this is after I don't know. Like, in most cases, this would be something where we'd be talking about something being too long or something. Like, this is very much a coda.
This film did feel like it was closing in on 2.5 hours, and I looked it up and it's 119 minutes. So that tells me that there is a little bit something going on here where, yeah, it does kind of take some detours here and there that maybe last a little bit longer than maybe they should, specifically like the prison sequences and things like that. And this kind of narrative, I think, is nice because this wraps everything up, and I like the way that they're kind of shushed off and like, you know, sent to the door, basically saying like, it's been 6 months, you need to end this, go away. And they're like, well, like, don't you want to figure out what happened? And they're like, no, we filed an insurance claim, we're good, go away. Like, I don't need to know what happened here, because honestly, in Charlotte Motor Speedway's kind of case, it might be just a good like publicity thing where it's just like, yeah, the investigation just, you know, it was solved internally. Right. And it's like, oh, interesting. You know, so her character introduction, I'll mention a couple of things real quick. Y'all both kind of honed in on her bad accent. I am like, I'll admit that I am really bad with accents. Like, people are like, oh, that accent was terrible. And I'm like, I don't know, whatever. Like, I just don't have an ear for accents, I guess, or bad accents or good accents. I'm just looking at it and I'm like, cool, Hilary Swank's in this movie. And she's got a very like stern look on her face throughout this entire film that I was like, I don't know why she's so like, just, she, she just seemed so stern, and I was just like, I don't understand what's going on. She seemed like such a weird character in the middle of this film to
not
kind
in
of
middle,
roll
at the
in.
End.
Yeah, to roll in at the end, right? To kind of sandwich into this film, and you're just like, what? Huh? But just the same, like, I just enjoyed kind of, because they are the aspect of like explaining what was actually happening and basically taking away any kind of faults in the film of like, oh, but what about this person? And oh, but what about this person? And oh, what? But so it's one of those things where that's the way it kind of works for me. And that's why that sequence and their introduction late into the film, I wasn't thrown off, because I was just like, yeah, because the heist just got done and now they're investigating it. So,
but I think the thing that's a little bit weird about that sequence to me is that they have like already created another in into that final coda, like the reveal that Channing Tatum did not actually give the money back, but you know through a an obscure series of incidents.
He kept enough of it. Like, he still gave it back, but he kept enough of it to basically say, here's this big publicity of like giving the money back and them knowing basically that without their electronic system, they have no way. They will just get overwhelmed. There's a sequence where one of the guys says, just start dumping the cash. I don't need to worry about you counting it right now. I need you to speed everything up, which is smart. It's like, okay, so it's going into this secure vault, right? We'll figure out the math later. Let's just keep going.
They could have just as easily not had Hilary Swank's character had that on the screen about them giving the money back, but then do that even through a brief voiceover. You can still do that interesting thing, which I actually did think was cool, of Adam Driver pretending not to know where his brother was and Melly not knowing, and that like sibling anger that comes across, that good moment with the arm. Like, I like that stuff, but that also is then combined with what you're saying, Bill, is that like sandwiching at the end, which feels very reflective of like the overreach that I was continually feeling.
I'm also curious,
just logistically, why was it easier to pretend to dump the money in the trash than to just steal all of it and then keep whatever amount of trash bags you were going to take anyway? And then give back the amount that he gave back.
I think because there's a certain amount of discussion that can't happen, that you basically have to see how people are going to react to, like, for instance, Daniel Craig's character, and see how he's going to react in that situation. Am I going to give him money? Is he going to be a complete and utter dick to me? Or is he going to basically say, I got away with it. I did something crazy for you. I don't know if I'm going to get paid or not for this situation, but I'm also not going to blow your situation, because basically Channing Tatum is basically keeping everybody out of the loop so they can't reveal anything and blow the whole scenario up.
I'm not saying why didn't he give them the money right away. I'm saying, why was it easier to throw the money away, have to get a guy to drive that dump truck, and then have to dig it out of the dump? Why was that the easier choice than just stealing all of it and then only one with the money? Yeah, he was in that truck. That's why he was able to give it back. So he could just pop out a
less visually interesting.
Yeah, it is less visually interesting. That's a good point, I guess. Yeah.
That's not a good answer, but yeah.
Say that again? I didn't hear that.
It's more visually interesting for him to have had a second heist, quote unquote, going on.
Yeah.
I think
he may have kind of fallen in love with kind of stuffing more people in this film, you know, whether it's the special agents or kind of that second, like, final reveal. But I think there might have been something else about it as well, because don't they show that basically where are you going to put the money if you do get investigated? So what they actually show, if I'm not mistaken, is not only did they bury the money, right? Or take it to a dumpster, and then they literally are uncovering it. So it's been 6 months since they got the money.
So they just left all that money in the dump for 6 months because that's the best way they could think to not have someone stumble upon it?
I guess so. Like, in some way, that kind of makes sense, because if you start investigating this person and, you know, you maybe have enough to get a warrant to search their property, the last thing you need is for you to have a shit ton of money on your hands. Like, I don't know where that came from. You know, you don't need it on anybody's property and things like that. So I think that's probably one of those things where it's like, I don't know if y'all noticed that, but they're definitely like not digging it out of the trash. They're mm-hmm. digging it out from underground. So it's clearly been like bulldozed over. It's been a little while. They're not super clear on like the sequence of events there, how much time has passed. So I think that's kind of the visual idea is, hey, we dumped it in a dump and now we came back and we found it because – I get. Didn't they do something with like the location of it, or like I know the trash bag specifically had like certain twist ties, but I think they added something else to it beyond just like, oh, here's the location of it, and we just dig. No, it's I could have sworn they had like some kind of like GPS system where they
why he couldn't just bury it in the woods himself.
I think one more thing too is that it a little bit adheres thematically to the whole approach of the movie, in the sense that they are doing things that are both overly convoluted and things that are kind of half-assed. Like you think, for instance, of Daniel Craig and the dynamite, where you find out that he, you know, got the ingredients like when it seems like he's just going on a joyride out of jail and getting beer and gummy worms. Like, mm-hmm. like there is something to be said that kind of goes along with the movie, in the sense that like it is not this cleanly planned. It's not this cleanly planned heist at all. Like, mm-hmm. And things are as much led up to like chance. Like, they didn't know that the warden, for instance, was going to be as immovable as he was. Like, I see where you're coming from there, but like, as I think about it, I think a lot of this does want to be in this weird way of like being coherent, but also being like, wait, why the fuck did they do it that way? Yeah. Like,
sure.
Overly difficult.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, I agree with that.
It almost seems unnecessary for Adam Driver's character to go to prison too.
Yes.
I just thought about that. Now that we're talking about all that stuff. I mean, I don't know. Like, stuff like that I can kind of get over. I was just curious if anyone had, like, a good answer for that. But, like, things like him showing up and his daughter, like, singing West Virginia.
Well,
like,
I think they
had a strained relationship beforehand, and this was, like, an olive branch or a reassertion of her love for him.
I think the Adam Driver thing, honestly, is because it gives him a very easy alibi. I was in prison.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't have possibly been part of this heist.
Yeah, it's a good point.
And that also damages Seth MacFarlane's case, saying it was the guy with the missing arm that punched me in my nose. And it's like, dude, like, what are you talking about? Like, he was in prison. So, and then you go back to the warden.
Like, camera footage of that.
Not in the section of where they are, because that's kind of behind the scenes section where, you know, unless like oftentimes when you see like fights that are kind of happening back there, it's not from like a security camera footage. It's literally from like ESPN having just an overhead view, and they're like, holy shit, look what's going on in the pits right now. You know, it's kind of one of those things. I mean, sure. Maybe they should have some cameras back there. You know, it is what it is. But of course, there's also the fact that the like the system is down, right? So like they crash their electronic system. So mm-hmm. maybe that's part of it as well. Their security footage went down as well. So I don't know. Nah, you know, it is what it is.
Yeah, who knows?
I'm realizing not only is it that things just need to fall in place, but it is very much like how nice they are and how polite they are to people, which yeah. is why a lot of things go through too. Sorry, just a random thought I had as we were talking yeah, about this.
That is true. And I don't know. I don't know. Like, okay. So now that we've gotten the what's her face, Hillary Swank thing out of the way, and I've, sure. I've mentioned how pointless the West Virginia thing seems, like I really don't. I don't feel like I have much more to say. Like,
okay.
Yeah, the funny thing is, like, I for hating this movie so much, like, I usually have more to say, but like the movie feels so like thin and ethereal and cotton candy-ish that like it. I can't really. There's like no point in fighting that much, you know.
It's not like Baby Driver. I don't know what you mean.
No, you wouldn't, Michael. You're willing to die on any hill you can find.
No, I really don't think this movie is thin. I don't really like what it is, okay, but well, I think
now we
that's...
have a whole other argument to have.
All right,
Bill, well, how is the movie not thin? Like,
I think there is a lot of stuff going on here. If anything, yes. too much is going on here.
Yeah, I kind of agree with Mike, and that kind of criticism is like I think he kind of fell in love with having too many like little things here and there and here and there and here and there. Whether it's like, you know, like y'all have already said, like the Game of Thrones thing, I think in just about any other scenario, I definitely would agree. Like, yeah, that's going to date the movie, but honestly, it may not date the movie because he may not fucking ever publish these books. So, you know, it may continue to be a hilarious joke. I don't know. I guess we'll find out. You know, I don't know. Comedy can usually be one or the other. It can be kind of this kind of everlasting evergreen hilariousness, or it can be a reference to something in pop culture that's kind of a big thing and, you know, potentially dates itself, but or is just basically like, yeah, that was a thing back then. Like, I don't know what to tell you, because, you know, like the people not having cell phones in horror movies and all of this shit is kind of one of the reasons why a lot of people set horror movies before there were cell phones, or, you know, all of these, like, why are there so many films, you know, set in these situations where it's a period piece instead of just something normal? It's because writers have to get away or get around the fact that everybody has a fucking cell phone and everybody yeah. has a internet connection right now. And it sucks because that solves a lot of these things where it's like, hey,
and this is a joke about it.
Yeah, sure. You know, it's just one of those things where it's just like, shit, man. Like, how do I get around this? I don't know. There's... You had a really clever idea. Let's set it in the 1980s.
Go ahead.
Well, I mean, like, the whole movie, like, his impetus for doing this is, like, I'm going to get a lawyer to stop you from moving. And then that's, like, why he does all this. And then in the end, he moves. So, like, why?
Well, he can't use the money yet, so. It's been 6 months.
But if he went into this knowing that this was the plan, then what was he doing?
Well, he's just like living day to day, paycheck to paycheck. I feel like that, again, is like what this movie wants to be, in the sense that like that larger arc is entirely fluid. Like, I don't know. I kind of feel like a little bit of this, you know, like stagnant ending is just kind of baked into this entire premise, which, you know, you can obviously take or leave.
Yeah.
But I don't know.
Yeah.
I think the other final thing I want to say is that, like, please correct me if I'm wrong, and potentially I know you are just getting ready right now, really? But I think it is interesting to think about not only you know, not only if you want to make it regional in terms of like movies set in West Virginia, but in the South in general, like Hollywood doesn't really do movies about the South that aren't, you know, more, I don't want to say gritty, but like, I like going against any of the caricatures that we have for the South. Like you think of something like Howl or High Water, and that very much is a very dry form of humor. Like it's funny, but it's very much based in like situational, like specificity. And well, I think something like
Macon Blair starred in a few of those films where they kind of have kind of a gritty realism to them. You know, Green Room is one of those. I mean, not specifically set in the South, but it deals with a lot of these kind of backwoods kind of people and things like that. And not necessarily backwoods people because of where they come from, but like literally they live in the backwoods. Like that's literally where they live.
Yeah. But that's the thing. Like those things don't really have like comedy. Like there's something very different about the tone and the characterizations in this that we don't really get. And like, you know, maybe some people are going to find that broad. Maybe some people are going to find it really realistic, but I think either way, I do think this stands out by virtue of just being, at least right now, kind of an isolated vision of this way of life.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I think this film is just like so, in so many ways, so happy-go-lucky that
That's strange.
like it's just like everything about this film. Like even the prisoners are just like, I'll go along with this thing, and I won't actually murder anybody. You know, like they tie up the guards and like that sequence gets a little out of hand and you're like, whoa. And then like everybody's fine in the end. And you're like, oh, I guess nobody actually got shanked. OK, cool. Like y'all had this planned. Like y'all all kind of had this like which is weird why they don't all like get money, but we don't all see them or we don't see them all like actually get out of prison either. So it's just the one guy that.
Do you think that like every single one of them is going to get a limo?
You know, I don't know how much money was stolen. Like that's like the big missing figure here is we literally don't know how much money was stolen. Correct. And so like it could be millions. It could be thousands. I don't know. And if it's millions, like maybe they all get a little kickback from this. Or, you know, it is one of those things where it's like, yeah, I helped you plan this thing, but you didn't know what was actually happening. So you just went along with it because I told you to help me with this thing. So, you know, maybe he went up to the one person, right? And that's why we see him get money is because he was kind of the leader in that situation of like organizing this thing. So that's why he gets money. And it's a need to know basis. Hey, guys, we're going to do this thing, you know, like what else? Like nobody gets hurt. Nobody gets killed. Sure. So it's like, what else are you going to do? Like, hey, guys, like let's do this thing. You know, it's playing with it. It's playing with the reality. It's playing with the truth of it and everything like that. So I don't have that like, much of an issue.
Good natured. Yeah. Like not cynical. I don't know. Like now I'm making too much of this, but yeah, the more I think about this, it does feel really, really strange in the same way. Like, I mean, I know some people have compared this to the Coen brothers and the Coen brothers,
yes,
something horrible would happen to them at the end.
Sure.
In a Coen brothers movie.
Yeah. Someone would get hit upside the head with an axe.
Sure.
And just be like, whoa.
Or shot in the head for no apparent reason. Like,
yes.
It's just, yeah. I don't know.
Okay. Yep. Have any final thoughts or things they want to address about Logan Lucky?
You're probably going to be talking about this one at the end of the year, aren't you, Bell?
I don't know. I don't know if this will end up as my best because I think it might be
the best.
Not the best. No, okay. I didn't say the best.
He just said on his list.
Oh, okay. Yes. I thought he said, I don't know if this will end up as my best. And I was like, whoa, all right.
If it was going to be his best, that's fine, Brian.
Yes. No, it's not. He's not allowed to have his own opinions if I don't agree with them, Michael.
He is the host.
Yeah.
I will turn off your mic. Yeah.
Kick you off here and replace you with my daughter in a couple of years.
We'll see. I'm not sure where this will end up, but I think I'm definitely looking forward to rewatching this and maybe kind of watching it with some other people. I need to have more people watch this film and kind of gauge their reaction. Because as much as I would like to say, like, I see things in a box and whether you like it or don't, like, I always want to take other people's opinions and kind of gauge it and kind of measure it against my own reactions to a film that I've only seen once. So that's kind of what I like to do. So.
I've seen one review from a local from Boone County, West Virginia, but I definitely like to see more takes from people who are more familiar with, you know, this milieu, because I'm not.
Yeah. All right. I'm good.
Okay. Yeah, so that's it. That's the end of our the one that we're talking about, Logan Lucky. I have the IMDb page up. There is a massive banner ad for this movie above it.
Yes.
That consists of nothing but the words Logan Lucky. And I still have been goddamn struggling this whole time not to say it incorrectly. That is just where I'm at right now. Hopefully I'll be in a better mental place next week when we discuss something different. What are we talking
good time?
About?
Good time?
I have no idea.
Oh, good I hope time, it's good maybe? Time. Good time would be fun.
Or Nocturama? I'm not sure.
I am so looking forward to Mother! Exclamation mm-hmm. point. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I cannot get a handle on what that movie is, and I am excited for it.
It very much looks like a remake of Rosemary's Baby, but right? we'll see how that ends up playing out.
I am really worried that trailer is more spoilery than I think.
Oh,
it is.
Oh, it is super spoiler.
Well, you can't know that because, like, what if
it's true?
What if that's the first 15 minutes?
Yes, like we've gotten that before. I can't remember what movie it was, but we've definitely gotten that. Like, oh my gosh. Like, look at all of this stuff, and it all happens in the first 15 minutes. So you're like, wait, where does this movie go from there? So,
that trailer.
I was going to say, like, I once played the, what was it, Metal Gear Solid Sons of Liberty. They released a disc that was like you could play like 3 hours of that game. Nice. And I was like, you know, this is fun, but I feel like they've given away like the entire story. And then if you've ever played that game, you know that like immediately after that 3 hours that was in the playable first disc, you like change time frames, settings, and
can we do a podcast about the ending of MGS2?
just like all of that nonsense with Raiden and the computer simulation and the fucking sword fight. Yeah, I'd love to do that.
Yeah, I've never played any of those films. Games all the way through.
I don't know if you're missing anything.
I don't know.
It just seems like wacky chaos. Like that's like well made wacky chaos. But it's the same with like the Final Fantasy games. I've never played those either.
Action, I think is
welcome to the video game podcast.
Yeah, those games.
On video games.
Those games really piss me off because I just want to smash somebody. I don't really want to be espionage-y. And like I've played too many of those games. Like what is it?
The Splinter Cell?
Splinter Cell, where like as soon as you smash somebody, you're like, oh shit, that was a terrible idea.
I love that you guys call murdering someone in a video game smashing them.
Yeah, that's what I think of.
Oh my god. Anyway, we're not talking about video games. We're talking about the end of the show. So, congratulations, you listened all the way to the end. Why don't you join our Patreon and give us money. Why don't you join our Patreon, give us some money, because you've obviously listened this far, and you must enjoy
we're
it.
We're sorry.
If that's the case. Patreon.com/TheFilmStageShow. $1 an episode gets you access to our Slack channel and entry into all of our raffles. And, of course, if we get enough money, we will start doing extra episodes. Maybe, you know, if we get enough money, we'll start talking about video games. We'll have the video game stage show. Who knows? So, that's that. Also, don't forget to sign up for your free trial of Mubi. You get 30 days access to the most innovative and awesome streaming platform possible. You will get a new film every day that you can watch, and you have 30 days to watch, so you constantly have a rotating selection of films to watch. And they're all awesome. They're doing a Murnau retrospective, which is going to be sweet. And, yeah, that's that. So go to MUBI.com/filmstage, and you will get a 30-day free trial of Mubi. Check it out. Hope you enjoy it. Tweet at us what you watch on Mubi, and we will at least like your tweet. All right, guys, let's tell the fine people at home where we can be found between now and the next time that we come to talk their ears off. Bill Graham.
You can find me looking forward to Unsane, Steven Soderbergh's future film with Claire Foy and Juno Temple, on Twitter at CableBFG, and you can also find me on the Slack channel, having a lot of fun there.
All right, and Michael Snydell.
You can find me on Twitter at Snydell, where I will be talking about all the times John Denver showed up in movies this year. And you can follow my stuff on Letterboxd. I'm trying to help.
Alright. You can find me on Twitter. I'm at Brian J. Rowan. You can also, of course, find me on filmstage.com, where I do some writing. My personal site, dearfilm.net, where I also do some writing. Letterboxd at Brian J. Rowan. Really, if you just type that into any social network, you'll probably find me. And ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us today. And tune in next week when we'll be talking about perhaps Good Time, perhaps Nocturama. But no matter what it is, odds are we will disagree about its quality.
So. Oh, look at this. The film stage is actually quoted in the Wikipedia article on Unsane. Whoop.
Whoop. All right. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much. Tune in next time.